KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump has a new travel ban affecting almost 20 countries, mostly in Africa and the Middle East, an echo of a first-term policy he promised to bring back. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Palestinians in Gaza have been without reliable food or medicine for months. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We hear from a doctor just returned from Gaza who says his patients were civilians shot trying to get aid. Also, what happens when political change in Russia splinters a friend group, one side calling the other enemies of the people? It's Thursday, June 5th. On this day in 1947, Secretary of State George Marshall laid out a vision for America funding Europe's recovery from World War II, the Marshall Plan. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Israel says a special forces operation has recovered the bodies of two dual U.S.-Israeli citizens who had been held hostage in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
The Israeli military says it retrieved the bodies of Judy Weinstein Chagai, an Israeli who held U.S. and Canadian citizenship, and her husband, Gad Chagai, a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. The military says they were killed in southern Israel during the October 7, 2023 attack by the Mujahideen Brigades, a small militant group, and that their bodies were taken to Gaza by the group. This leaves the bodies of two U.S.-Israeli citizens held in Gaza. In total, around 36 deceased hostages and about 20 living hostages remain held in Gaza. Israel and the U.S. want a temporary ceasefire with Hamas and the release of half of the living and dead hostages. Hamas agrees but demands talks for a permanent end of the war. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Senators are working on the multi-trillion dollar tax cut and spending package backed by President Trump. Billionaire Elon Musk calls it an abomination and is demanding lawmakers reject it. Republican supporters say they'll work to make it pass. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports a nonpartisan office has finished totaling up the bill's effects.
Yesterday, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office scored the current version of the bill that passed the House last month. They found it would add $2.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. And they said the biggest driver of that is extending a tax cut program passed during Trump's first term. It also includes dramatic cuts to Medicaid as part of a Republican effort to pay for this legislation. But the CBO says even as they force 11 million Americans to lose their health insurance, it falls way short of paying for the bill's price tag.
NPR's Claudia Grisales reporting. The suspect in the fiery attack last weekend in Boulder appears in a Colorado courtroom today to face dozens of charges. 15 people were hurt when they were hit with burning devices. Separately, a federal judge is temporarily halting the deportation of the suspect's family. From Colorado Public Radio, Kira Damari reports.
The suspect's wife and five kids were detained by ICE on Tuesday. Eric Lee is the immigration attorney representing the family, and he likened the move to a style of intimidation found in Nazi Germany called family or collective punishment.
The idea that the Trump administration can impose punishment on family members for the crimes, alleged crimes, that they did not commit is an assault on the most basic democratic rights of the entire American population.
Lee said a line has to be drawn on who can be charged with a crime. Hearings on the family's deportation are next week. For NPR News, I'm Kiara Damari in Denver.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A federal judge has ruled the Trump administration must allow a group of Venezuelan migrants deported to El Salvador a chance to challenge their removals. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg ruled the Trump administration must provide the migrants the chance to contest their deportations under a rarely used wartime power. He said they also must have the chance to prove they are not members of a notorious gang. Boasberg has given the administration a week to specify how the migrants can get their cases heard. Boasberg is the judge who had ordered the Trump administration to turn deportation flights around if they were violating his previous orders. U.S. Army helicopter flights around the Pentagon are suspended after two passenger jets were recently forced to abort their landings at a nearby airport. NPR's Joel Rose reports the head of the Federal Aviation Administration made that disclosure during testimony yesterday on Capitol Hill.
Acting FAA Administrator Chris Rocheleau told a House committee that the agency has barred the Army from training and routine transport flights around Reagan Washington National Airport.
They're not flying right now. We've shut those down until such time as we're comfortable with kind of what we'll call new rules of the road.
Two passenger planes were forced to abort their landings in May because of a nearby Army helicopter. That incident followed the deadly mid-air collision between a helicopter and a passenger jet in January. Separately, Rocheleau said the FAA is not currently considering whether to lift a production cap on Boeing's 737 MAX jets. The agency imposed the cap of 38 planes per month after a door plug panel blowout in 2024. Joel Rose, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. When President Trump signed a travel ban 8 years ago, it was one of his signature moves, and it caused nationwide convulsions.
Yeah, Trump had explicitly promised to ban Muslims from the country, and he had to change the ban several times to get it past the courts. This time around, the president's new travel ban is just one of several controversial moves he made on a particular Wednesday in June.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez covered the first Trump term and is covering the second and is with us once again. Franco, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What did the president sign this time?
Yeah, Trump signed an order that will completely stop the travel to the U.S. by the citizens of 12 countries. Now, they include Afghanistan, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. Citizens from seven other countries will be subject to partial bans. They include Cuba, Sierra Leone, and Venezuela. All this goes into effect on Monday.
What was the justification?
Well, the justification for such a sweeping ban was that the White House, at least, says the action was needed to protect the U.S. from terrorist attacks and that these countries lacked the right vetting capabilities. In a video statement, Trump actually cited the firebombing attack in Boulder, Colorado, as an example of why this was necessary.
In the 21st century, we've seen one terror attack after another carried out by foreign visa overstayers from dangerous places all over the world.
Now, Steve, I do want to note that that man charged with that attack is actually from Egypt, which is not among the countries listed in the travel ban.
Okay. I am just remembering 8 years ago, this happened very early in the administration. It happened rather abruptly. There was chaos at airports. There were immediate lawsuits. What has the response been this time?
Yeah, I will say advocates were ready and they were waiting for this to come, already taking action. Now that it's here, They acknowledge that while the Trump administration did make some exceptions, such as carving out an exception for Afghans who worked for the U.S. government during the war in Afghanistan, there are still tens of thousands of Afghans, especially family members, who will not be allowed to enter the U.S. under the new ban.
I'm glad you're with us because you were around for this last time. How did the first round of travel bans work out?
Yeah, you kind of mentioned it. I mean, it was very, very controversial because of the backstory of that first travel ban. You talked about the mayhem. I mean, during Trump's first campaign for the presidency, Trump called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. As you noted, there was all the chaos at the airports. And also, you know, our listeners will remember all the protests as well. The ban did face legal challenges and was blocked by the court, but Trump made all sorts of revisions. And eventually, the Supreme Court did approve the third iteration of the ban. President Biden rescinded it, though, on his first day in office. Now it's back.
Oh, and a little bit more expansive, apparently, than the last time. This is not the only thing the president did yesterday. He escalated his fight with Harvard University. In what way?
Yeah, he signed another proclamation to suspend visas for new international students at Harvard. The White House says it's a move to, quote, safeguard national security. Now, it's unclear, though, what force this order will actually have, because last week a federal judge ordered the administration not to make any changes to Harvard's student visa program. I do think it's safe, Steve, to say this proclamation will be appealed.
NPR's Franco Ordonez, thanks for the insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Over days, Palestinians trying to reach a site for food aid distribution came under fire and dozens were killed. That's according to health officials and healthcare workers in Gaza. A U.S.-Israeli-backed aid organization has now paused all food distribution temporarily. In the backdrop of these killings is an acute lack of food along with continued daily bombardments. So what's it like inside one of Gaza's last functioning hospitals treating the wounded? I spoke to a British orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Graham Groom, just after his return from Gaza, where he treated patients at a hospital in the south of the Strip. He says the patients he saw were not fighters, they were civilians trying to get food aid. And a warning, this conversation discusses injuries and violence.
We would work through the day with, I can only really describe it as mangled bodies and broken bones, mutilated flesh. The recent events have included mainly gunshot wounds, and that's been quite unusual in the last 3 weeks.
So let me just back up for our audience. You know, Gaza was under a full blockade for several months. Now there is a U.S. and Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is run by private U.S. contractors, that came in to create aid distribution centers. And they just paused it over reports of these shootings. But also, they have denied anybody's been shot.
Yes, I've heard that. I've heard the denials. It's certainly happening. I'm not sure what it is they're denying. I think that what we saw and heard was that those in need of food aid were told where it would be and when, were told how to get there, and were encouraged to travel early. And along the way, they were attacked. There have been other justifications for these killings, but none of them stack up as far as our perspective is concerned from receiving the wounded.
And what did you see when receiving the wounded? And what did you hear?
Well, I think if we start with what we heard about and what we know, when Palestinians gather in groups for food and for water, they are absolutely distinctive. They are of all ages, but many are young. They are extremely thin and they are very poorly dressed. One might say, rags. And they are quite unmistakable for some military force. They're palpably unarmed. But this congregation appears to have been met with rifle fire, and particularly with fire from the quadcopter drones that carry a gun that fires bullets.
Right. We've done some extensive reporting on the quadcopters, which Israel continues to not acknowledge or deny using.
Well, they are hugely feared in Gaza.
Yeah.
And their use appears to be widespread.
Did you have what you needed to work on these patients and to help these patients? I mean, what was the situation at the hospital?
One of the objectives of our project has been the provision of equipment. There is a shortage of absolutely everything, and even the most basic equipment will likely run out. I think the other thing that is so striking about every single one of the cases we see is that none of them were injured alone. They were particularly the ones who were injured in bomb blasts. And it seems there's been a pattern of individual families being attacked. There was a young man, aged 11, who was one of the ones who was wheeled into the operating theatre on a blood-soaked trolley at the end of our ordinary list. He was one of a family of two adults and 10 children. He was the only surviving child. Mm. So that is the context of each of the people on whom we operate. And I could repeat that story. There was another wee boy who particularly sticks in my memory. His name was Yakub. He was 7. The blast had broken both legs above and below both knees and had flayed the skin and flesh from his legs. Now, we were able to care for his legs. And while I was writing the operation note and he was in recovery, it was heartbreaking to hear this poor little 7-year-old boy, this little scrap of humanity, calling for his mother who was dead. Those stories are not in isolation.
That's just devastating.
My top line is that the current campaign is directed almost exclusively at the blameless and the defenseless, and the killing must stop. There is no justification for it, in my view. There is no purpose in it. It will only generate further conflict. My message to anyone who has the power to influence events in Gaza is that the killing must stop.
That was Dr. Graham Groom, a British physician who just returned from a medical mission in Gaza. Dr. Groom, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
When it comes to what happened at the food distribution aid site, is the Israeli military acknowledged firing warning shots near what it called a threatening group approaching troops, but denies firing into a crowd. It says it's investigating and is aware of reports of civilian casualties.
Some other news now. One of my favorite buildings in the New York skyline is up for sale.
It's the Chrysler Building. Steve, you can't afford it.
Oh.
If that name does not put a picture in your head, look it up. It's a silvery building with Art Deco curves in the metalwork on top.
When construction workers put the pointy spire on top in 1930, the Chrysler Building briefly became the tallest building in the world. It's still tall, but the interior is dated. Ruth Culp Haber of Wharton Property Advisors has been leasing space there.
The Chrysler Building is considered one of the true grand dames of New York City real estate. That being said, at this point in time, it's facing a real crossroads.
Many people work remotely, not in skyscrapers, and companies that do lease space want something flashier.
Because the fact is, the modern commercial office user has changed a lot in the last 100 years. And, you know, they want now bigger windows, higher ceilings, ping pong tables, pools, cafes.
Previous owners of the building have not done well. The Abu Dhabi Investment Council once bought a majority stake for $800 million, only to sell for $150.
Wow.
Old buildings are worth less, in part because renovating them costs more.
But for the right buyer, here's your chance for a tall building at a low, low price. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, poet and novelist Ocean Vuong joins us to discuss his new novel, The Emperor of Gladness. Set in a fictional small town in Connecticut, it follows a 19-year-old grappling with addiction and despair who forms an unexpected bond with an 82-year-old widow living with dementia. Together, they contend with memory and survival. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Two of Russia's most prominent investigative journalists are out with an investigation of their friends. Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borogan recall the year 2000, when they were young reporters and Vladimir Putin came to power.
We wanted to report on the most sensitive topic on the Russian security services. And for this, you need to have sources.
They took jobs at a Soviet-era newspaper with sources in the Kremlin called Izvestia. There, they befriended fellow journalists, a reporter in Putin's press pool, a war correspondent with stories of hitchhiking to the front lines in Chechnya, a writer with fringe views and a collection of North Korean postage stamps. They are who Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borogan call our dear friends in Moscow. The memoir tells how their friendships ruptured as Russia grew isolated from the West.
Back then, it was a group of people in their mid-20s, early 30s, full of hope, very bright. And as it used to be very popular in Russia, we spent nights talking and discussing and drinking sometimes outside on the streets, in the parks.
Yeah, and you were all passionate about politics and your country and the future. And then you start to feel the influence of the state at Izvestia, where you work. Your stories are changed from the top down. An intelligence officer gets hired to the politics desk, and you eventually resign. And then you chronicle how, over time, your friendships dissolve. You become separated by ideology, by border. Why did you want to connect your personal stories in these friendships to the political trajectory of Russia?
Well, because this story was really tied up with political events in our country. And at some point, for instance, our friends who were getting more and more pro-Kremlin nevertheless supported us. For instance, when we got this horrible terrorist attacks in Moscow in 2002, we were extremely critical of the way the Russian security services responded to this crisis. Most of our friends supported us and helped us. The people who now are firmly on the Kremlin side back then believed that we shared the same idea of journalism, that we were in the same profession. But gradually, when the country went through more and more political crisis, it was getting more and more clear that we all, as political animals, we needed to make choices, and we did our choices, and they made their choices. At some point, it led us to the situation when a very close friend of ours put us on the list of the enemies of the people. Mm. To be honest, it was such a big shock for us.
You said we all made our decisions in that moment. What were the decisions you both made, and what were the decisions your friends made?
Our decision was absolutely predictable and clear. We decided to oppose the Kremlin, but we didn't start it back then. We started it in 2000 when Putin came to power. we have never been nostalgic for the Soviet Union. We understood the opportunities we got after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That was the difference between us and our dear friends.
Were you surprised to watch your friends make different choices?
Yes, to be honest.
Of course, a lot. We were surprised. We were angry. We loved them a lot, so they were friends. So we were outraged by this.
To be honest, the most shocking development for us was that at least three of our friends decided to cooperate with the Russian security services at some point. And given that we, the Russians, all know what Russian security and Soviet security services did under Stalin and after that, well, why to cooperate with them? That was a big question to us.
So now you're in London and you are deemed enemies of the Russian state for the work that you continue to do. For this book, you reconnect with your old friends. What was it like to do that? People who were your friends who are now propagandists, one of which declared you an enemy of the state.
Oh, that was very hard emotionally. The first call I did was to the guy named Petr Akopov, who wrote an article calling for the final solution of the Ukrainian question, which reminds us of language used by Hitler in Nazi Germany. My father from Ukraine, he's from Odessa, so many of my relatives, all of his relatives, they live in Odessa. And I called him. It was a really very hard feeling. You were still listening to the voice you knew from your past. To me, it was like a torture.
It was like torture?
Yeah.
What did you learn from living as reporters, as journalists, in an ever more restrictive Russia that might interest an American audience right now?
Well, that's sometimes it's very tempting to think that if you go close to someone who has authoritarian habits, it's better to be inside than outside because you have a chance to change things. But it's just an illusion. Many of the Russian intellectuals, the best and brightest of Russian society, they decided to side with Putin for that very reason. But at the end of the day, we just lost the country because of that. You cannot befriend a crocodile. It's just, at some point, it will eat you alive.
Do you believe you'll ever go back to Russia to live and work as journalists in your home?
Yes, I'm certain at some moment we will get back to Russia and it will be a free country with free media.
And why do you believe that?
Russia is a country full of surprise.
Yes.
I mean, our parents, they lived in the Soviet Union and they never had an idea that they could live in the free country, but they did. Now Russia is bad, but not so bad as the Soviet Union used to be.
Well, I also think that, of course, Putin made things really horrible, but I do believe that now in the modern world, which is still modern and still globalized, the country is capable of sudden change.
Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borogan are the authors of the book Our Dear Friends in Moscow, The Inside Story of a Broken Generation. Thank you both so much for your time and for this book.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
The Ting Ting's newest album is a hard pivot from what you might expect. But the duo says they're grateful for the love people still have for their old music.
It's just constantly being used all around the world, and that makes it so we can make music that we want.
I'm Juana Summers. Hear more on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
A federal judge is giving the Trump administration 1 week to figure out how more than 100 migrants sent to prison in El Salvador can challenge their deportations. As NPR's Tobias Smith reports, the judge says the migrants should have been given that chance before they were flown out of the U.S. under an 18th century law known as the Alien Enemies Act.
U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg wrote there's significant evidence that many of the migrants are not members of a Venezuela gang, as alleged, and, quote, thus languish in a foreign prison on flimsy, even frivolous accusations. The U.S. Supreme Court has affirmed migrants' rights to challenge their removal, and Boasberg says it's now up to the government to figure out how to, quote, make good the wrong done and grant the migrants due process, even as the government says they're officially in the custody of El Salvador. The Trump administration had no immediate comment, but has previously called Boasberg's rulings an egregious abuse of the bench. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
President Trump is banning people in 12 countries from entering the U.S. and partially restricting entry for those in seven others, beginning Monday. The president cites national security concerns, including potential terror attacks. Among countries under the full ban are Afghanistan and Iran. This is NPR News from Washington. President Trump is accusing Iran of what he calls slow-walking talks to reach a deal over its nuclear program. The president says the U.S. is seeking to prevent Tehran from building a nuclear weapon. Iran denies it wants one. NPR's Jackie Northam is following developments.
The key sticking point is whether Iran should be allowed to enrich some uranium for civilian purposes to run power plants and for medical use. And there have been reports in recent days that the U.S. proposed a compromise whereby Iran could enrich low-grade uranium but give up its stockpiles of higher enriched uranium, which could be used to make a nuclear weapon.
Iran's supreme leader has dismissed the latest U.S. proposal as being against Iran's interests. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is in Brussels today. He's been pressing NATO defense ministers to step up their spending on defense from the current 2% benchmark to 5% of their country's gross domestic product.
We're here to continue the work that President Trump started, which is a commitment to 5% defense spending across this alliance, which we think will happen. We think has to happen.
He says defense spending needs to go up to give NATO credibility and deterrence beyond the U.S. military. President Trump spoke by phone today with China's president. It's unclear what Trump and Xi Jinping discussed. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. President Trump is scheduled to meet German Chancellor Friedrich Merz today at the White House. It will be the first face-to-face meeting between the two leaders. They'll discuss Russia's war in Ukraine, trade tensions, and the transatlantic relationship. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now to talk about this. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so what does Merz want from today's meeting?
Well, I think Meretz is going to try and create a positive first impression on President Trump. Mm. Meretz is a new chancellor. He's been on the job for about a month, and he's representing a country that Trump often criticizes for taking advantage of the United States, whether it's over the American security umbrella in Europe or trade policies that Trump feels are unfair for the U.S. So Meretz is going to want to show Trump that he's looking for a more collaborative relationship with the United States.
And what about President Trump? What's he looking for from Germany?
Yeah, like with other leaders the president meets, he's looking for a public expression of appreciation of his strength and the strength of the U.S. on the global stage. He might also be looking for an assurance that Germany is serious about building up its military. And on this front, Meretz is positioned well because even though he's only been chancellor for a handful of weeks, he's been able to release money in the German budget for an unprecedented investment of hundreds of billions of dollars into its own military.
Now, President Trump has held very public, very contentious meetings with world leaders this year. Right. His meeting with Ukrainian President Zelensky, South African President Ramaphosa come to mind. What are the odds that he dresses Meretz down in the Oval Office publicly?
Yeah, this is a scenario that Meretz's team is likely preparing for. I spoke to political scientist Catherine Kluwe-Ashbrook about this, and she put the odds of Trump trying to embarrass Meretz at around 60%. Mm. But she added that Meretz, who comes from the business world, might handle it pretty well.
Friedrich Merz is not known to sort of hold back his emotions, and yet this is a high-stakes diplomatic play for him. So best-case scenario, because we have seen this happen with other state visits, Friedrich Merz can practice these situations, and I would hope that his team has made him aware of the kind of sort of more confrontational elements that might be part of this conversation.
And Leila, she also added that Meretz's demeanor, he's outspoken and is known to sometimes be aggressive. And curiously enough, she added Meretz's imposing stature, he stands 6'5", might help in a situation where Trump is looking to test him.
Donald Trump likes two things. He likes tall men. They seem to impress him. And he does appreciate it when people find a strong way of arguing with him. He doesn't just want people to roll over.
Okay, it sounds like we're talking about a boxing match?
How, yeah, kind of.
Yeah. How will the Germans know whether Meretz does well in this meeting with President Trump?
Well, I think it's not only the Germans that'll be watching this, right, but all of Europe. Meretz leads Europe's largest economy. Meretz himself understands the broader implications. So in many ways, I think Meretz can count this meeting a success if he's able to show that he can not only stand up to President Trump, but that he can convince Trump that Germany and Europe remain important partners, not only in the global security realm, but also in a realm that President Trump specializes in. That's making deals, making business deals, increasing trade, ensuring that Europe and the U.S. remain on the same team from an economic perspective.
NPR's Berlin correspondent, Rob Schmitz. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
President Trump wants to stop new international students at Harvard University from entering this country. Last night, the president told Secretary of State Marco Rubio to consider revoking visas for existing Harvard students. The president alleged that Harvard has not shared enough information about its students. Now, the administration has made that claim before, and on this program last week, Harvard's president said it isn't true. Harvard says all these actions are illegal, part of a campaign of retaliation against a university whose speech the president doesn't like. A judge has already blocked a similar effort by the administration. The U.S., in fact, has made multiple moves against international students. So how does all of this look from overseas? Reporter Willem Marks has the perspective from Britain.
More than a million international students, including from the UK, are currently enrolled in American colleges, according to the State Department, contributing around $50 billion to the country's economy each year. But higher education application portals show the number of prospective students searching for U.S. universities declined sharply since January, with one provider predicting demand among foreign students could fall 70% within a year.
I do think families and students have to think about it very carefully of, do I want to be in the United States when clearly there does seem to be a conflict between the federal government's policies and what's going on at a select group of universities?
David Hawkins founded education consultancy The University Guys and each year helps dozens of British students apply for US universities. He's advising his clients to delve into the policy details, but is also not surprised at their current concerns.
It's those people who have options who are looking at the US with quite big question marks right now.
More than 10,000 British students are among those currently enrolled in the US. But if in the future such students choose to stay in the UK, the long-term effects of any US policy changes may be just as profound for British institutions. That's according to Kalwant Bhopal, a professor of education and social justice at Birmingham University, who's previously taught at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and Harvard.
If there is this ban on international students in the US, because these international students do tend to disproportionately come from wealthier backgrounds, I think you will see a shift to them coming to the UK and going to those elite universities.
Her research on both sides of the Atlantic has focused on education access among minority groups, and she says those with less privileged backgrounds could find it even harder to win spots at top UK universities.
Higher education actually has become a capitalist enterprise. So if you have an international student who's paying £20,000 a year fees compared to a home student who's from a disadvantaged background, universities, I would argue, are more likely to take the international student because of the financial impact it has on universities.
Many education experts acknowledge British universities rely on fees from international students because teaching UK students and conducting research both lose them money. More than 35,000 Americans already study in Britain, second only to Italy as a destination. But even though more foreign students could pursue college places in Britain and better finance UK universities, says Nick Hillman, director of the Oxford-based think tank the Higher Education Policy Institute, the broader US situation will still worry British academics.
In the short term, the UK will undoubtedly benefit, but in the long term, the cause of global research may very well suffer.
International recruiters at top UK universities, including Oxford, Cambridge and the London School of Economics, declined interview requests on the current situation. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks in London.
This is NPR News.
Nintendo fans have waited years for a new console, but will they be able to get a Nintendo Switch 2 as it rolls out this week in the middle of a trade war? That's next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. Physicists at Loughborough University in England have some high-tech nanotechnology equipment. The machine involves a very, very, very small needle that can make very, very, very small patterns. To test it, they made a drawing smaller than the width of a human hair, the pictures of a violin. So now if you're overly upset about something truly trivial, you know where to find the world's tiniest violin. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Federal rules prohibit states from housing minors in adult jails for more than 6 hours without a judge's order. Those rules also say juvenile and adult inmates should not hear or see each other when they're in the same facility. In recent years, Maryland has violated those standards more often than almost any other state. As part of a partnership with APM Reports, Rachel Bay at member station WYPR has this story.
When public defender Erin Seegears visits her juvenile clients at a county jail near Annapolis, Maryland, she says they often have red eyes from hours of crying.
Literally, the uniform's hanging off their shoulder because they're adult uniforms on children.
Maryland law requires youth as young as 14 to be charged as adults for certain crimes. As a result, children and teens were booked into adult jails more than 800 times in 2023. At the time of our analysis, bookings were on track to surpass that in 2024. And the state's treatment of those juveniles has drawn concern from state officials and advocates. In interviews and court hearings, some teens described sharing jail cells with adults, being bullied by them, and fearing sexual assault.
An adult who was incarcerated there showed him a shank and told him, "I'm not afraid to use this."
This is social worker Aubrey McCarthy testifying in court in 2023 about a 16-year-old boy's week-long stay in the Charles County Detention Center in Southern Maryland. She said he was also forced to give adult inmates his food.
He reported he did not remove any of his clothes or shower the entire week he was there for fear of sexual violation. He referenced he took bird baths in the sink, keeping his clothes on.
In other cases, jails confine youth to their cells for as much as 23 hours a day to keep them separate from adult inmates.
For a lot of my days I was there, I was in my cell for 24 hours.
This 17-year-old girl was in the Prince George's County Jail just outside Washington, D.C. for about 2.5 weeks. NPR isn't using her name because she was a minor at the time. She said she had panic attacks while locked in her cell for days at a time.
I just was laying on my floor. I was crying. And I felt like I couldn't breathe, like it was bricks on my chest. I couldn't breathe.
But even while in her cell, she said she could still see and hear the adults who tormented her through her cell doors and walls. That's a violation of federal rules. Maryland stands to lose about $350,000 in federal funds between this fiscal year and next because of its high rate of violations. The state had more violations than any of the 47 other states that have agreed to comply with the federal rules to be eligible for grants. That's according to Jenny Crable. She is the director of the Youth Justice Division at the Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy, the agency that administers the funds.
If we can fix this issue by October, we may get our funding back in 2 years.
In recent years, the Maryland State Legislature has declined to advance proposals that would have removed minors from adult jails. Crable says she's done waiting for the legislature.
We're probably not going to be able to eliminate violations without a law, but to significantly reduce them, I do have some hope, and we're doing some work to get that done, but it is a multi-agency, multi-system approach to do that, which is not easy.
She says that involves talking with law enforcement about reducing the number of youth charged as adults, with jails about finding new ways to keep youth separate from adults, and with the Department of Juvenile Services about speeding up court procedures that prolong juveniles' jail stays. But so far, those agencies have not agreed on the right fix to the problem. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Bay in Baltimore.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. A second man has been identified in the bombing of a fertility clinic last month in Palm Springs, about 100 miles east of Los Angeles. Authorities arrested him late Tuesday and say he supplied large amounts of chemicals that were used by the FBI's primary suspect to make explosives. From member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Ament reports.
The Department of Justice alleges Daniel Park of the Seattle area shipped some 270 pounds of ammonium nitrate to Guy Edward Barkis, who later drove a car containing a bomb to the clinic and detonated it in what the FBI considers an act of terrorism. Barkis died in the explosion. Bill Asaley, who's the U.S. Attorney for California's Central District, says investigators found lab equipment and bomb ingredients at Barkis's house in 29 Palms, about 50 miles northeast of Palm Springs.
Park spent approximately 2 weeks visiting Barkis's residence in 29 Palms in late January and early February of this year, spending time together, running experiments in Barkis's garage.
The FBI declined to say how the two men knew each other during a news conference on Wednesday. Park is charged with providing material support to a terrorist and could face up to 15 years in prison. Asaley says that Park, an American citizen, was not in Palm Springs at the time of the explosion and fled to Poland days later. He didn't say why Park chose that country as his destination. Asaley says Park, who's 32, was deported by Polish authorities and arrested late Tuesday at JFK Airport in New York City. Akil Davis, who's with the FBI, says Park and Barkis shared fringe ideologies.
They don't believe that people should exist. So there's tons of terminology out there, antinatalism, pro-mortalism, nihilism, these all are intertwined.
Davis says a search of Park's home in Seattle found instructions to make an explosive similar to the one used by Timothy McVeigh in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. He says they believe Park was trying to recruit others in online forums. Park appeared before a federal judge in New York City on Wednesday and is being detained without bail. A spokesperson for Asaley says Park will be moved to California in the coming weeks. Efforts to find an attorney for Park were unsuccessful. Meanwhile, the doctor who runs the fertility clinic that was destroyed said all the embryos survived the attack and they will rebuild. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament in San Bernardino.
Just about every source of news in this country has had to deal with technological change. People getting their information and entertainment in new ways, and that includes C-SPAN. It was started by TV cable providers, funded by them, and offered on traditional cable, which a lot of Americans no longer have. Sam Feist, C-SPAN's chief executive officer, hopes to get C-SPAN on streaming services.
It's the only service that does what C-SPAN does. We provide coverage of the House and the Senate and committee hearings and unfiltered coverage of the president, the president's top officials. So there really isn't that service that does what C-SPAN does.
Feist is trying to move C-SPAN into the future and also trying to change the way that C-SPAN covers the government and the country. Do you ever think about broadening it out, you know, game shows, reality TV?
Well, some people think that American politics, particularly in 2025, is a reality TV show. It's a fast-moving, fast-paced, maybe as fast as any time that I've seen in Washington. But we're adding new programs. We're launching a new program this fall called Ceasefire. That's something that we have not done before. And we've added more live content to make sure that everything that's happening in real time, people can see.
Do you worry about broadcasting lies?
Of course we do. We think about that all the time. One of the things that we're known for is unfiltered coverage. So we'll show you an entire committee hearing. We're not going to just show you one piece of it. And if a Republican or a Democrat says something that the other has a problem with, you will immediately hear the response. But we're not a news channel. We don't fact check in the same way that the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal might.
So you mentioned a program called Ceasefire. What is this new program you've come to talk with us about?
So I spent many years at CNN. I produced a program called Crossfire, which was a raucous debate program where the left and the right battled it out. The purpose of the program was not to really find common ground or compromise. It was really to have a raucous debate. And when Michael Kinsley, the legendary progressive TV host and columnist and magazine editor, when he left Crossfire, he and I visited and he said, Sam, one day you should do a program called Ceasefire. try to see if there's an opportunity to find those places where Democrats and Republicans do agree, because they're a lot more than the public would see. And that little voice, Michael Kinsley's voice, has been inside my head for years. And I got to C-SPAN last fall, and we're going to launch Ceasefire this fall. And the idea is that we're going to bring on Republicans and Democrats to, at least during this program, not focus on where you disagree, focus on where you agree, check the acrimony at the door, and see if we can find some common ground.
What has been the response as you've talked about this idea?
It's been remarkable. We've had members of Congress and senators who've personally reached out to say, I want to do that show. Here's who I'd like to go on with. My best friend in the House or my best friend in the Senate is actually a Republican or is actually a Democrat. And so I think America needs this.
Do you worry about missing the point with a program like this? Because we are in a moment where people are questioning everything, and there are real, not fake, divisions about almost everything.
Absolutely. And there's plenty of time for that. And that is 98% of what you see on TV today. And this program is not going to solve all the divisions in America. But at our core, I am one of those people who believe that Americans actually agree on more than they disagree. I mean, we had Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton in the 90s reach a balanced budget for the first time in a generation. It hasn't happened since. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill worked together on saving Social Security, on saving the economy, on ending the Cold War. Ronald Reagan believed that government was the problem, and Tip O'Neill believed government was the solution. And yet, they found common ground. They were friends. They worked together. That's what this program is about for me.
I think you're fundamentally right. People are human beings, and they do tend to be more on the same page than they may even feel like they are. But it does seem that the financial and political incentives run all the other way right now.
I think that is true, but this isn't the new thing in America. There was a book I read once called Differ We Must. I think a guy named Steve Inskeep came on C-SPAN to talk about it, and the cover of the book was a red-blue divide. This is not new in America. Doesn't mean we can't get some things done.
Sam Feist, thanks so much. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Steve.
He's the CEO of C-SPAN, and this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin.